the latest on the science and medicine of COVID-19. So many researchers around the globe are working on different aspects of the COVID-19 virus, it's hard to keep up. There's word today that MIT may have developed a quick test for the virus based on the technology behind the gene editing tool called CRISPR. Pfizer has begun clinical trials for a vaccine, and others are in different phases of trials. Maine's own Jackson Lab has ramped up its production of COVID-19 testing kits. The CDC has added more symptoms to its description of people who have contracted the virus. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will try to get our heads around some of this recent information. What are your questions about the science and medicine of COVID-19? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. We are continually learning new information about how COVID-19 behaves and what can be done to control its spread. Today, we'll talk with medical experts about the latest developments in understanding the virus and how to respond to the pandemic. Joining me, Dr. Herb Cushing, who is Chief Medical Officer of Spectrum Healthcare Partners. His background is in infectious disease. And Dr. Edison Liu, he's president and CEO of the Jackson Laboratory. He was involved in controlling the SARS epidemic in Singapore. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you have questions on all this news about symptoms or treatments for the coronavirus? Are you confused about whether or not to seek out an antibody test? Send an email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Thank you both for joining us today. You know, when we decided to do this program today, it was to respond to all of the information that's been coming out so fast. And yet this morning, there's even more. It seems as though it's like a tidal wave. And Dr. Liu, I want to start with you and ask you, you have consistently called on more testing. And when I say more testing, I don't mean a little more testing. You think this country needs to completely change the way it's testing people. How would that happen? And what do you think needs to happen before we reopen?
Well, I think, first of all, is the scale of what we're talking about. And it's not impossible given the industrial might of this nation. And so at the bare minimum, we're going to need about 500,000 tests per day, all the way up to millions of tests per day. And it just, there's no perfect number. But there is a general consensus amongst those of us who have worked in pandemic fields that you're shooting blind if you don't have adequate testing in the population. The key issue here, and it's the same principle for social distancing, is really to separate out individuals who are infectious from those who can be infected. And the best way to do it on a surgical manner, as opposed to a blunt manner, as we're sometimes doing now, is to know within the population who carries the virus and who doesn't. Unfortunately, we don't have the benefit of just simply looking at symptoms, because this is a very strange bug, and many individuals are either mildly symptomatic or not symptomatic at all. And so this kind of separation becomes very important, along with contact tracing. Those two things are really important.
Well, let's talk about that. You said, you know, our country can do this. How quickly can we do this, given the limitations we're hearing about, limitations on reagents and equipment? How quickly do you believe the country could be testing at the level that it ought to be?
Well, you know, it's a supply chain issue, but, you know, this country has ramped up their capabilities in several world wars and several crises. And if there's one thing that the U.S. is known for is this industrial might. Some of it is just unleashing the individuals who can do it, and the other is, quite frankly, regulatory hurdles that originally slowed us all down. And now that they're opened up, I think that there is an opportunity to do so. But it is very complicated, and just to have the test alone is not sufficient. One has to identify ways to bring the test to people, and that cannot mean going to a hospital. It has to be much more of a general approach. So it's the same thing as, let's just say, using CVS pharmacies to distribute flu vaccine versus only letting people get the flu vaccine in a general hospital. You know darn well that many of us actually get our vaccines from the pharmacy because they're distributed. And this is one of the issues around the vaccine. It's not just how many can we produce. Not vaccines, but the tests. It's not just how many we can produce, but how can we actually recruit individuals to be sampled.
And one more question before we move on to Dr. Cushing. I wanted to ask you your reaction to the news today and all the national news organizations on NPR and the New York Times that MIT appears to be in sort of the prototype phase for a very quick test, sort of like a pregnancy test, instead of using urine, using spit to identify coronavirus. Do you think that this is good news?
Well, using saliva is actually what we are transitioning to because it's so much easier than to probe the nose. Now what the MIT technology, it's not necessarily that you can use spit, but they use CRISPR. Again, it's a unique form of molecular detection, which is quite clever. I've actually been tracking this for several months now, and the theory behind it is really brilliant. It was just a matter of reducing it to practice, and we've all been waiting for some kind of indication that it actually works and that it could be scaled up appropriately.
Dr. Cushing, I want to turn to you. We have talked before about how the list of symptoms put out originally by the CDC doesn't appear to be the only symptoms for coronavirus, and now CDC has expanded their list of symptoms. What are you seeing in your patients? Do you believe that the updated list of symptoms is accurate, or are there even more to be added?
Well, we added new loss of taste or smell to the list recently. So it was reported fairly early on that some patients were losing their loss of smell someplace in the illness, usually before they had other symptoms. And then they soon developed symptoms of COVID, and that's how people connected the two issues. I've seen patients with other respiratory infections for many years lose their loss of taste or smell transiently and then have it restored gradually as they get better. So I think this respiratory illness is no different in that it causes this, but it's a little different in the frequency it seems to be causing it. It's a significant minority of patients in some small groups of reported patients. So if someone comes to the office with new loss of taste or smell and no other reason for it, that's a reason to get testing. As Dr. Liu points out, we need to be able to test many more people and for far simpler reasons than is happening now.
Some of the other symptoms that have been reported are stroke-like symptoms. Tell us about that.
There are other viruses that cause significant vascular disease. Influenza is the classic one. Patients may present sometimes with coronary artery disease, with a heart attack, or with a stroke, and then be found coincidentally to have influenza. And what really happened was that the influenza created an inflammatory state that resulted in them either having a heart attack or stroke. And that same phenomenon is happening in COVID. So some patients are presenting to the hospital with a heart attack or stroke and are then found to have COVID. So that's an indication to do the virus testing on top of the other respiratory symptoms.
And what is this about things that affect your skin, whether it's a rash or the frostbite toes? Have you seen that?
I've seen pictures of it. I haven't seen it yet. But the Italians early on, about a month ago, started reporting rashes in their hospitalized patients with COVID. At first, it was total body rash, some hives, and then some lesions that looked a little bit almost like pox-like lesions, like you would see with chicken pox. And not long after that, others began reporting painful red lesions on the toes and sometimes on the fingers. People know it when they get these lesions. They're not subtle. They're very tender. The digits are swollen, and it's difficult to wear shoes or socks sometimes. It resembles a condition known as chilblains, which is an inflammation of the small blood vessels that happens in cold weather in some individuals. Why this is happening with this virus isn't known, but I suspect it's related to inflammation in the small blood vessels. Whether or not it's similar to what's happening with the phenomenon that results in a stroke or heart attack, we don't know yet.
I'm sorry, Dr. Liu, I want to come back to talking about research and scientific development. We talked a little bit about developing a better test, a test that could be deployed more quickly, but there are other things that researchers are racing towards right now, a potential vaccination and also a potential treatment. How close are we to having some sort of treatment that is effective on a wide scale?
You're asking two different questions, treatment and wide scale. I would reserve wide scale to a vaccine, which is really necessary to prevent individuals from getting the disorder. The treatment, if you want to call antivirals that, is really to treat the virus once it is established in some in individuals. It's really in that sector, that is the antivirals, where by virtue of just simply the testing and the life cycle of development, we're going to get a solution hopefully faster than the vaccines. There has been some signals recently that at least one drug called remdesivir has some benefit. Earlier on, most of the studies that have been randomized, in my just observation, just reading, has not been terribly impressive. But the remdesivir one, which you may have heard of with the study that included over 1,000 individuals, showed a shortening of the time to recovery, which is really a good sign, given the fact that those people who were enrolled in this study were really quite ill. Perhaps Dr. Cushing, who's closer to the treatment of patients than I am, I'm more into the development of drugs, could actually comment on that. But I'm very hopeful, given the large number of studies that are ongoing right now, the fact that the reagents are here for groups to test the drugs to move forward. And the only last thing I want to add is that a lot of individuals, a lot of groups are working on antibody therapeutics. You heard about the antibody as detection, but it's generating monoclonal antibodies that are against the spike protein of the COVID-19, the SARS-CoV-2 virus, and it to a degree neutralizes that virus in the bloodstream. There's many different approaches are being tried right now, and many of them are in the testing phase. So we're hopeful that in the next few months we'll have even more signals of something that will work.
Dr. Cushing?
Yes, let's keep talking about remdesivir first and then maybe talk about some of the other potential drug targets. So as Dr. Liu points out, if you just think about treating patients who have already acquired infection, there are a number of different drugs under investigation for that. One class of those drugs are drugs that insert themselves as false building blocks in the growing RNA chain. This was the first sort of drug that worked with HIV, for example. AZT is the first HIV drug that helped our patients a long time ago, 1986. So remdesivir works in a similar way against this virus. And in the first study that was released, where we have some reported data through the media, but I haven't seen the raw data yet, it showed that people who were sick and in the hospital got better in 11 days on average compared to 15 days on average for other patients. So a modest improvement in time to getting better, and that's a good thing if you're one of those sick patients in the hospital. But there was no improvement in the percentage of patients who died in the information we have. Larger studies are pending, so we'll find out more. But I have hope that this drug will have some benefit. I suspect it will be paired with other drugs that inhibit the virus at other steps in its manufacturing new copies of itself. And those studies will need to be done in order to know for sure.
Dr. Liu, you've written and talked a lot about how testing is really important to reopening the economy. Does treatment play a role as well? If we can develop a treatment that is effective for many people before a vaccine is developed, how does that play into the equation?
It clearly does. If nothing else, it reduces the range of severity of the disease. Obviously, if you have a disease that people can catch that can lead to hospitalization and death, if you can truncate hospitalization and death, then people can get on with their lives, even if they have the disorder. Now, you don't want to hand out the drug willy-nilly, because these viruses have a unique ability to quickly mutate and become resistant, but it would be it definitely would be helpful. I do believe, however, that the ultimate control will really come in with an effective vaccine.
And what do you believe? I know that nobody knows for sure, but what do you believe is the timetable for that?
For which one, the vaccine?
Yeah.
Well, you know, the usual timeline is 12 to 18 months, with 18 months being the standard if you wanted to start from scratch. But, you know, there's a lot of hope. There's some escalation of capabilities. But I think your audience should know the complexity of testing a vaccine. It's not just making an antigen and then trying it out. You have to try it out on people who are normal, who aren't infected, waiting for them to get infected. That's very different from testing remdesivir. And then the second thing is, let's say you prove that it works and that it doesn't backfire on you, as once in a while a vaccine will, then you have to produce hundreds of millions of units to make it useful. That is different from a remdesivir, where, you know, a few hundred thousand units is enough to make a difference.
Thanks so much for that. I want to talk about antibodies and the antibody testing that's been made available in Maine. We do need to take a quick break, so we'll talk about that when we get back. We'll also hear questions from our audience. So if you have questions, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We're talking with Dr. Herb Cushing and Dr. Edison Liu, both experts on infectious disease. Dr. Liu, president of Jackson Labs. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from New England Cancer Specialists, saluting their own healthcare professionals and those all over Maine who are working to keep people safe during this critical time. And Husson University, committed to strengthening Maine's future by preparing the business, health, and communication professionals of tomorrow. Husson.edu.
The novel coronavirus is testing our resilience in unprecedented ways, affecting all aspects of Maine life. Join Maine Public this week for Deep Dive Coronavirus, conversations with our news team that trace the outbreak in our state from its source through the present and looking ahead to the future. We'll talk about the state's response to the virus and its impact on our education system and the economy. And on Thursday at 1, tune in to Maine Calling for an America Amplified call-in special looking at the coming tourist season in New England. That's this week on Maine Public Radio.
Public radio is where you turn for critical information and updates about the coronavirus pandemic. But we also make sure to bring you moments of beauty and peace.
And Hirata said one thing was certain. The tree would still bloom. He pointed to small red buds. They're starting, he said, just a few days away.
Help us bring you these moments. Make your Giving Tuesday Now gift to this station. Here's how.
You can pledge your support right now at mainpublic.org, and today all gifts are being triple matched.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we are talking about the latest medical news on COVID-19, including treatment, testing, antibodies, and vaccines. My guests are Dr. Ed Liu, who's president and CEO of the Jackson Laboratory, and Dr. Herb Cushing, chief medical officer for Spectrum Healthcare. Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. Just this morning, Dr. Cushing, I received another press release that yet another urgent care facility in southern Maine was going to offer an antibody test. This follows another urgent care type facility that issued a press release last week. If someone thinks they may have had COVID-19 but was never tested for it, or if someone has been living with someone who had COVID-19, would you recommend that person at this point get an antibody test to see if they've developed antibodies to COVID-19?
Jennifer, yes, I would. The time is now to start figuring out who's got antibodies to this and who does not. For the listeners, we're early in the process of figuring out what is the best antibody test, but that shouldn't stop us. We have to begin somewhere. I have two bits of advice for people who are curious and want to get their antibody status checked. It's to remind them that most of the tests will measure two types of antibodies, an IgG antibody, which will likely be longer lasting and comes up a little bit later in the course of infection, and an IgM level that comes up very quickly in the course of infection and may decline sooner than the IgG level. Sometimes we have one of those present and not the other, and sometimes we have both. We don't need to get into the nuances of all that on this call, but those are reasons why folks should talk with their doctor before they get the test, because these early tests will mean some things, and there are things that they don't yet mean or that we don't understand yet. The other bit of advice I have for folks is to ask what company produced the test that was used when they do get tested. That may be important later if we figure out that one ended up being better than the others as we learn more about them. There are three important pieces that we need to understand about the antibody testing. The first is if there's a lot of cross-reactivity with the four less severe types of coronavirus that have been circulating as cold-type viruses for years. Many people have been exposed to those viruses, and we don't want just to be picking up people that got exposed to those old ones but not the COVID test. We have a little suspicion that the antibody tests that are available now don't show much cross-reactivity with those old viruses, but it would be good to know for sure. The other two things we need to know are if the antibodies that are produced are protective against future exposure to COVID and how long those antibodies last.
And we don't know that yet. There's been a lot written about how some of these early antibody tests have a lot of false negatives. What would you do with the information if you do get the test and it shows negative? I read an article just this morning, somebody who was tested several times and got a different result different times.
Okay, so I think it would be good to know if the test was done with the same assay, with the same manufacturer's kit. That would be interesting to know. I'm not quite sure what would make it false negative, but I think we'll learn more as we go along. As we know more about this, we'll have more information about people that are known to have had recent infection documented by the PCR test for viral RNA, who then have an antibody test that is positive or negative. And just doing it more will give us more information about those situations and what they mean.
So you're recommending that people get the test in part for their own information, but also in part to be part of a great research, so that the gathering of information about the antibody tests themselves.
Yes, but that only happens in organized ways as the tests are being studied.
Dr. Liu, what are your thoughts about the antibody tests that are available now?
Well, I think Dr. Cushing's recommendations are well placed. The key issue here is not to get a false sense of security that if you're antibody positive, that somehow you're protected from the virus. Naturally, in most cases, for other viruses, that is the case. But this is a very strange virus because there has been documented in individuals who had the documented infection recovered with elimination of the virus, then come back with another infection with the virus. Now, whether that infection was from within that individual that just reemerged, or it came from a reinfection, we still don't know. But that doesn't give us a lot of confidence that the antibody response to the COVID virus is really protective for all people. And this is why the admonition, that we need to be careful about the interpretation and that we still have a ways to go in terms of understanding, you know, what a positive antibody test means in terms of do you have immunity to the virus.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to go to a question here from Michael, an email. Can your guests explain why COVID-19 manifests itself in so many different ways in different people? Does that mean there are different versions, or does it simply interact differently with the predispositions of each person it uses as a host? Given the symptom complexity, can it be accurately diagnosed clinically, or is a test essential to differently diagnose it? A lot of questions, but good ones. Dr. Liu, I'll start with you.
Your listener is really quite astute. The interesting thing about the molecular signature of the virus is that it doesn't mutate that frequently. It mutates. Every virus does, but in terms of its frequency, it's more stable than many other viruses that certainly I've worked with in a population basis. So it's not likely to be a viral variation that's causing this remarkable change. Just the fact that older people respond differently than younger people suggests that there are other factors, related to the physiology of the individual that's going to make a difference. And it's quite clear that a lot of the symptoms, as Dr. Cushing had mentioned, is related to the immune response and not necessarily the virus itself. Don't get me wrong, the virus does damage, but the immune system, how you respond to the virus, also can give you many symptoms. And it's possibly that response to the virus that differs from individuals to individuals is a cause of many of the different symptoms.
Do you believe there are genetic factors into how different people respond and the different symptoms that people will have?
Is that a question? I'm sorry.
Yes, yes.
The genetic factors of the individuals, you mean?
Yes,
the human
yes.
Yes. Chances are, let me put it this way, every infectious disease has a what we call host genetic variation that modifies their both the virulence and the response. A classic example is the bubonic plague that killed between 20% and 40% of European populations in the past. It was quite clear that a genetic variation in individuals, they're not protective, but it really reduces the severity of the infection. And so human genetic variation will make a difference. But in the context of what we're seeing right now, first of all, every population, no matter where you are in the world, has been affected by this, affected severely. with the similar range of symptoms, with a similar severity as individuals grow older. So, yes, there's probably some genetic variation that affects this, but there's also what you might call normal human physiology as well.
All right. We'll go to Margo, who's calling from Orono. Hi, Margo. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Hi there. I'll have to take my mask off. I'm in the grocery store. I had a very simple question, which is, how can a person in Maine get tested? What are the conditions you have to meet, and where can you go to get tested?
Dr. Cushing.
The PCR test to see if you're actively infected now and are shedding the virus is being done in patients. So people that have symptoms suggested that they have the virus. It's being done on emergency responders, and it's being done in healthcare workers. So go start with your primary care doctor, and they may triage you or send you to a testing site. That's the quickest way to get done. If you're talking about the antibody test that would pick up whether or not you'd had infection more than a couple of weeks ago, can be done also through your primary care doctor and ordered through them. And there are a number of labs that are doing the test in the region.
And Dr. Cushing, this is interesting because you said if you're showing symptoms, you can get tested. That wasn't the case a few weeks ago, but now there are enough tests that people's doctors can order them tests, even if they're not a healthcare worker, don't have an underlying condition, et cetera.
Yes, it's a little bit more open. It's not perfect by any means, but start with your primary care doctor and push it, and let's try to get more people tested for this. We need
All right.
to know if you have symptoms. The only way to figure this out and isolate people with active disease is to identify them when they're infected.
All right. Thank you so much, Margo. I have Judy on Facebook says, I heard Danielle Allen from Harvard and Tom Frieden, former director of the CDC, on Point yesterday. They discussed the necessity of testing, too. Dr. Allen suggested the possibility of state consortiums to ramp up the levels we need. I've heard no discussion from the state about this, though. Is this the type of focused testing currently part of the state planning as regards to reopening? I know neither of you work for the state, but Dr. Liu, I'm wondering if you've heard conversations about some sort of state consortiums. I understand Jackson Lab is working with the state of Connecticut. Are you also working with the state of Maine?
Maine, not yet. We're constantly seeking some discussions to move that forward. But in Connecticut, we've been deeply involved with the Governor Ned Lamont, and his administration as they're ramping up quite significantly the testing capabilities of Connecticut. So in March 10th, we decided to stand up our own COVID viral PCR testing. By March 23rd, we were running at a modest 100 a day. We're now at 700 per day, and our plans are in the next 6 weeks to go to 20,000 a day, 20,000 tests a day. And that's all directly in collaboration with the state of Connecticut, that decided to deputize three units, Jackson Labs, Yale University Medical School, and a company called Semaphore, to provide up to 55,000 tests per day for the state of Connecticut. And yes, indeed, I believe that it really requires a state or state consortia to come together to make it happen. It is not a trivial. It's not trivial to ramp it up to this level. Besides the fact that you need to get the devices, the machines, to negotiate the reagents. But this, as I mentioned earlier, the simple fact of where are you going to get a test, where people are actually going to be sampled for these, the logistics of moving 20,000 pieces of material to laboratories a day, and then to have the informatics systems to return the results in a facile manner is clearly not trivial and requires a lot of logistics, and that's what we've been really working on at this point.
But the state of Maine has not reached out to Jackson Lab about developing tests for Maine citizens.
No, not yet.
We'll go to Diane calling from Owl's Head. Hi, Diane. Go ahead.
Hello, Jennifer. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good. Thank you. My question is about the strength of the virus as it exists in our bodies. So if we had very mild symptom or two that came and went over the period of 2 or 3 days, but we've been isolated pretty much since from going to work and so forth, and we're feeling fine, what is your guess about what's happened to the virus that maybe caused those minor symptoms? Has the virus decayed? Has it just lain dormant? Could it cause infection in someone that we come across or spend a meal with, spend
All right.
an hour or so with?
Dr. Cushing.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Wonderful question, by the way, because there are parts of this that we know and parts of it that we don't know yet. When you look at the folks in China who have had this virus, either mild, moderate illness, and measure levels, measure the amount of virus in their nasal secretions or in their bloodstream, just about all of those folks had the virus disappear from their nasal secretions and from their bloodstream and from their bowel movements at about the 2 to 3 week mark of the illness. And then after that, it couldn't be found. So that would suggest to your question that the immune system had eliminated the virus and it was entirely gone from the body, and that was that. And as we talked earlier in the call, Dr. Liu's suspicion and my suspicion is that there are genetic factors that determine how well someone controls the virus and why someone has mild illness and why some people get more severe illness. We know that younger folks have much more mild illness and older folks have more severe illness, but we don't yet really know why. It remains to be seen, to part of your question, whether or not the virus will be latent in the body. You may remember some recent viruses, the Zika virus and the Ebola virus, that caused recent outbreaks in the last decade. We were surprised when both of those viruses were found to be shed and latent in the body far longer than I thought that they were going to be. You may remember that the Ebola virus could appear a year or two later and hid out in odd places like in the eye, and was also capable of being transmitted sexually. So stay tuned. This virus has shown us some twists so far, and it may have some more to show us. But right now, we think it's gone at the 2 to 3 week mark.
Diane, thank you so much for your questions. So many good questions coming in. We'll try to get to as many as we can after a break, but we do need to take a quick break. This is Maine Calling.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Breakwater in Portland, offering summer day camp programs for kids ages 3 to 18. Registration at enrichment.breakwaterlearning.org. On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
On May 5, 1828, the United States military established a post in Houlton. In the 1820s, a border dispute between Canada and Maine, a conflict that became known as the Aroostook War, prompted the United States to send troops to northern Maine. The dispute concerned a tract of land that stretched north from Mars Hill to near the St. Lawrence River and arose from ambiguous language in the Treaty of Paris of 1783 that ended the American Revolution.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Marshall Communications. Happy birthday, Maine! The Daily Maine CDC briefing on the coronavirus will take place this afternoon at 2 o'clock. Maine Public Radio, Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page will all bring it to you live. In addition, each day's address is archived at MainePublic.org for later on-demand viewing or listening. Just choose the television drop-down. Again, Maine's CDC briefing with Dr. Shaw is scheduled for 2 this afternoon and carried here on Maine Public Radio, as well as Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we're discussing the latest medical news about COVID-19. Joining me, Dr. Herb Cushing with Spectrum Healthcare and Dr. Ed Liu with the Jackson Lab. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I'm going to go to a tweet now. This asks, what is the possibility that the lockdown is having the opposite effect, delaying herd immunity and prolonging the pandemic? Dr. Liu.
I think this is the issue of herd immunity, I believe, is way overblown as a solution. I'll tell you why. Herd immunity does not occur in a population unless the majority, and the estimates are anywhere between 70% and 90% of a population has immunity against a virus. If you believe the case fatality, that is how, if you get COVID-19 and what is your likelihood of dying, at a minimum, it's going to be 1%. To get at 90% of the American population, 300 million people have to be infected, which means 3 million deaths have to take place before you get a herd immunity, and probably in a 10% hospitalization rate, 30 million Americans will have to go to the hospital and a number of them into the ICU. To me, that is not a solution. That is absolutely not a solution. The only way we can get to herd immunity, as the questioner is intimating, is really through a vaccine. And that is my hope, is that we'll get to a vaccine soon enough and that people will be willing to be vaccinated so we can get herd immunity in the most humane way.
An email from Susan. We are a couple in our 60s. We live in Florida and came to our vacation house in Maine in February for ski season. Given the shelter-at-home directive and lack of testing, isolation, and contact tracing, in addition to a potential vaccination and treatment, would you suggest we remain in Maine for additional months since we travel by car and where the number of infections and deaths are lower than on the west coast of Florida? Dr. Cushing, if they're your patients, would you recommend they stay put?
Stay put. Yes.
That was an easy answer.
Yes. Stay in an area where there's less transmission. And I agree with Dr. Liu. We need to play for time to get two things, to get a vaccine and also to get to effective drugs that will decrease the burden on the hospitals and the very, very ill patients who do get to the hospital. That's all we're doing. We're not playing for time to get everyone immune because there's herd immunity. We're playing for scientific advances.
Well, let me ask you that question, that expression, playing for time. Does that mean that we ought not be opening up at all?
Oh, is that to me or to Dr. Liu?
To both of you, but I'll start with you.
The economy can't stand it. I'm not an economist, and there are people that specialize in the healthcare effects of bad economic situations. You've seen some of that with the opioid epidemic, which, by the way, killed 60 or 70,000 people a year a few years ago. So similar to the number of deaths this year from COVID. So neither of them are to be diminished in any way for their impact on society. So a horrible depression worldwide is going to have a terrible health toll on folks. So we have to do something to get the economies going, and there's this unfortunate balancing act that we have to pursue, I'm afraid.
Dr. Liu.
I totally agree. I think the concept it has to be threading the needle. This I firmly reject the idea that you have to lock down the economy in order to to maximize to actually totally eliminate this virus, which I really don't think we can anymore. At the same time, I'm really not against this idea that we can return to before COVID-19. That, to me, is also foolhardy. So somewhere along the way, we have to thread the needle. And that's the hardest thing to swallow in terms of policy. Let me just say, however, to thread the needle, you have to have a clear view, good eyesight, right? You know, to take that needle through that little hole. And for the COVID-19, the visual that you must have to navigate economy and safety is really aggressive testing.
An email from Carol. Can you identify the two urgent care locations offering the antibody test? Carol, I'll tell you, I've received news releases from AFC Urgent Care in South Portland and Scarborough Urgent Care. But Dr. Cushing has also mentioned that private practices are able to give that test as well. A tweet from Allison. Is it possible to have developed the antibodies just by virtue of having been exposed to the general public without developing symptoms? The answer is yes, right, Dr. Cushing?
Oh, yes, that's right. Yeah, that would mean that you got infected with the virus but just never knew it. And I think we're going to find many folks who are in that situation. They don't remember just how mild the symptoms were, that it just sort of passes by. I don't remember if I had mild cold symptoms a month ago or a week ago even, really. So, yes, we're going to find out people that have antibodies and clearly were infected with the virus at some point in the recent past but just don't recall it.
An email from Bob. I just read that the virus has already mutated. Do you have information on whether that's true? Dr. Liu, I'll throw that one to you.
But all viruses mutate as they pass through a population. The two things that one has to watch for is how quickly does it mutate, and then, which, by the way, the mutation is an adaptation of that virus to the different hosts that are that it infects. And then the second is whether or not those mutations actually have meaning. Every virus mutates, and it doesn't mean, however, that each mutation has meaning, has significance.
All right. We'll go to Liga calling from Friendship. Hi, Liga. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. I would like to address concept called innate immunology to your guests. I know there's some controversy around this, but there have been two articles in the New York Times, one in April and one in May, about how maybe a very old vaccine, both for polio and tuberculosis, could possibly protect against severe infection, maybe not all infection, and that it's being explored, especially in Europe, where the BCG vaccine was very popular, not so much in the States, but certainly polio was. So it's called innate immunology, and I know I have had the BCG vaccine when we were refugees in Germany. My mother was a pediatrician, and I think believed in that vaccine, and I was just wondering what the general feeling here is with researchers on
sure.
That issue.
Sure. Dr. Liu.
There's adaptive and innate immunity. That is actually your immune system that everybody has. The adaptive is the one that is specific against, let's say, COVID-19. The innate is frequently more general immune response. The BCG was a vaccine for tuberculosis, but many vaccines generate an innate response. The innate responses don't last forever, so you would probably have to be immunized with BCG in order to get at the any protection whatsoever. The problem with all these is that the concept of innate immunity has been around for a long, long time. But it's never been a terribly effective way to control, an epidemic or pandemics. In terms of whether it's used currently for any medical purposes at this point, I'll leave it to Dr. Cushing to answer.
So the BCG vaccine is it's an interesting one. It's been with us a long time. It was commonly administered in countries with a high incidence, so and a high number of annual cases of tuberculosis, because it did cut down on childhood TB cases and on tuberculous meningitis cases. So health departments in countries where there was a lot of TB, who saw a lot of childhood TB and TB of the spine, found it worthwhile to give the vaccine. It stopped being used in the United States and Europe a few decades ago because the tuberculosis cases weren't frequent enough to warrant the large BCG vaccination programs. And giving it makes you give a positive response to the tuberculin skin test for a long, long period of time, sometimes for life. So the administration of BCG removed our ability to know if someone had acquired new tuberculosis, and it wasn't terribly protective. But the question now is whether its immune-boosting effects will have some ability to make the person immune to the coronavirus. There's a hint that won't be true. I saw a paper 2 or 3 weeks ago, and I can't remember where it was from, but it looked at the difference between COVID cases in countries that have had current or recent BCG vaccination programs countrywide versus countries that did not. And there was not a hint that the BCG vaccinating countries had less COVID than the others, if you kept all the other factors as similar as you could. So good question, and I've had that one from others before, but I think we're going to have more effective immune treatments in the form of vaccines coming up. I hope we do.
Liga, thank you for your question. I'm going to try to squeeze in one more really quick question from Maggie. Is insurance likely to cover an antibody test right now, even if one's doctor has not ordered it? Dr. Cushing, do you know the answer to that?
Yes, yes.
Oh, wonderful. Yep. Well, we have so many questions, and I apologize to all of you. I have not been able to get to your questions, but we're out of time. So appreciate your time. Dr. Herb Cushing, Chief Medical Officer for Spectrum Healthcare Partners, and Dr. Edison Liu, President and CEO of the Jackson Labs. Thank you for being on Maine Calling today and in the past. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Today's program will be rebroadcast at 7. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Stay with us. The latest update from CDC Director Nirav Shah is coming up in a few minutes here on Maine Public Radio. It's also